Oh, yeah, we're good.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 1st, 2017. And colleagues, today we're going to open up actually a public hearing on Senate Bill 5535, Department of Revenue. And what we're going to do is have a conversation around the core system replacement project, get a status update there. We're going to talk a little bit about revenue management and tax compliance. And within that, we'll be hearing from folks from the Personal Tax and Compliance Division, the Business Division, and the Tax Gap section. So, John, what we need to know as we kickstart this.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, you did a fine job of outlining today's agenda. Just the last week, there was a request to have a brief update to kick things off on the status of the core system replacement project, and the agency is here to do this. And then for the following few days, this week will be tax compliance today and tomorrow. And then on Wednesday and Thursday will be collections activities. The agency was asked to provide some specific information, just an overview of their processes, metrics, current service level budgets, and vacancy factor. And then they're also asked to provide any updates on recent past legislation, legislative audits. And then they're asked to report on past investments and progress they've made in the interim on various activities. They were also asked to provide a kind of a data-driven process with both pre- and post-CSR core system replacement implementation data and internal metrics data. So they're here to make their presentation, Mr. Co-Chair.
Perfect. Thank you. Madam Director, come on up and bring up with you, whoever you would like. Welcome. If you'll just introduce yourself, we'll turn this over to you.
Good afternoon, committee members. Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chairs Manning, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Nia Ray, Director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I have with me Gary Johnson, our CIO, and also the project manager for GenTax. As you may recall, Eric Smith was in this position during phase one. He has been loaned to a sister agency to manage their project on a temporary basis. So Gary Johnson is filling the role as project manager in his absence. I've been provided 10 minutes or less to give you an update on GenTax. I am striving for the or less, as we have a fairly packed agenda. So with that, we'll move forward. The GenTax project is a four-phase project. Currently, we've completed the first three phases on schedule, under budget. The final phase, the fourth phase, is scheduled for implementation November 13th of this year. And we have no reason, based on past performance, to believe that it will not go as planned. During phase one, however, I suggested that we would be having a very different set of conversations about GenTax and its progress. We're moving away from the implementation plan, which is stellar, but moving into stabilization in reality, the rubber meeting the road, if you will, how it's actually performing. And the chart before you illustrates how these expectations in reality coexist with these types of projects. A well-known IT research firm, Gartner, I do believe the name of the firm is, established this hype model specifically directed at these types of projects and how expectations in reality meet or don't meet in many instances. And you can see the expectations are fairly high at the beginning. We expect a lot from these projects. However, by the time you get to where we are at post rollout three, the reality of what we have, even though it is working and it is a competent solution, those expectations simply can't be maintained with the heavy lift that we have to do as a department to implement this project. Please keep in mind as well that the solution that we ultimately chose, GenTax, is not a customized solution to the Department of Revenue. And we did this to maximize our ability to work with other states, an and also acknowledging that our initial legacy system was a customized system. So our department employees have to learn an entirely new system that was not customized to the department. And while there are benefits to that, it is a heavy lift. So if you are hearing concerns about Gentax from staff, that may play a role. It is a heavy lift. We acknowledge that. And to offset that, we are employing employee engagement tools. We are doing everything that we can to ensure that our employees understand that we have their backs during this very difficult process. Some of the benefits of Gentax, we are seeing an increased number of dollars generated per case, and that is specifically toward our geared toward our personal income tax efforts. Case selection is more efficient and effective because we have a case selection tool that is also a part of Gentax, and we're working less complex cases more quickly. Next. We are seeing roughly a $500 increase per case with respect to our caseload, and that simply illustrates the prior description. Next. I'll allow Gary to discuss a little bit more about our interfacing with other agencies, but to encapsulate the success that we're having here, we have roughly, I think, 430 interfaces, and there are only about three that are currently at issue. So with that, Gary.
Yeah. Co-chairs, members of the committee, again, as Director Ray mentioned, my name is Gary Johnson. I'm the Chief Information Officer for our Department of Revenue. Yeah, we actually have well over 500 unique interfaces in this environment. And they're very complex, and some of these interfaces go well beyond that our information being supplied to other agencies. In some capacities, we're merely a gateway where we're passing additional information from one agency, a sister agency, to another. It's an amazingly complex environment, and I think we've, by all accounts, can say we've been very successful to date. That said, after every rollout, we do go through a period of system and process stabilization and refinement. We're seeing that now with rollout 3, and we're working through any of the little glitches that might rear their head.
So finally, because during our last presentation, there was a specific concern about an interface with the Child Support Services Division, we just wanted to update you that that has been successfully completed. We believe, according to their assertions, that we have addressed all of their concerns and we've moved forward. And that completes my presentation.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Ray, so can you go back to the last slide there? What is your, how do you interface with the Department of Justice? I don't remember that. What is that about?
Co-chairs, Representative Nierman, can you provide a little bit more specific? You're talking about, it's typically an FTP. Is that what you're getting at?
No, I don't need to know, like, the method. What kind of data is it? You have somebody who's behind on their child support, and they report that to the Department of Revenue, and then you keep their tax return? That's the kind of – is that – you're nodding. That's – I got it right then.
That's essentially what it is, yeah.
Good.
I'm not an expert in that area, but, yes, that's my understanding.
Good. Thanks.
And co-chairs, Representative Nierman, in this case, it was specifically that. There was a miscommunication between our two systems. There was a refund that got caught up in that inability for those systems to communicate, and we had to resolve that issue on behalf of the taxpayer.
Thank you.
So, let me ask this question. So let's go to slide or page 4. There we go. With case selection being more efficient and more effective, I'm assuming that additional triggers are being pulled. Do we need additional staffing?
That's the co-chairs, Smith and Manning, committee members. We would benefit from filling the positions that are currently vacant in that area. Both in our collections and audit, and Joanne Martin, our personal income tax division director, will speak to that in greater detail. But I will say that we do need assistance in that area. And we've been operating at a very high level, understaffed.
So part of what I think this committee wants to see, either in our communication today or in the future, near future, is what are we going to do to make sure that staffing occurs?
Mm-hmm.
To get those folks in the right position to make sure that as this new GenTech system is doing its work and in this case, case selection is being done more efficiently, how do we make sure we have those human resource folks in place? We want to know the plan.
Senator Manning, Representative Smith, and committee members, I certainly agree we will get that to you. And I go even beyond that. I think we have to do that as a department. Part of the challenge is many of the benefits that we're realizing from GenTax are just being realized. So we're setting a long-term strategy for benefits that we're only realizing, and there will be additional benefits. So whatever we present, we do caution that this is a very preliminary assessment of the benefits that GenTax will offer and the needs that the department will ultimately incur because of all of those benefits. But I certainly think that in the short term we can come up with some type of plan.
Okay, and we're on the same page here. In addition to that, I want to know how we're going to retain these folks.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. I've got a son in law school. Okay, he's about to enter his second year, and by the way, what I'm sharing with you is just family conversation. I shared with him, as you graduate, you need to go work for the Oregon Department of Revenue and work there for 2 or 3 years and then head off and go get in the private sector. And you know, I'm not, you know the context of this. I wonder how do you keep these folks? And I'm not asking you to explain that today. You can have your folks do it. But I want to know how we're going to address that issue. How are we going to recruit, and how are we going to retain these folks, knowing that you've got a private sector that makes it difficult for you to do it?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that is a huge issue for the state as a whole. And DAS can probably give you more insight into how we are addressing that as a state. I will say that as a manager and as a department leader, it is increasingly difficult to maintain the type of working relationships that we want to have with individuals and retain them. I will take it a step further. As a former Missouri director, we were experiencing the same dynamic in Missouri. I think all state governments are strapped for, you know, resources. We're not as competitive. That's just the reality that we're in. So there were discussions about how to make quality of life, you know, more of a draw. Millennials aren't necessarily caring about quality. They don't have kids. They don't need benefits. So all of the things that make, you know, state government employment attractive aren't necessarily going to attract the millennial generation as it currently stands. So, yeah, we have to have quite a few discussions about that. Where we end up, I don't know. But you're right on point.
Okay. I'm going to go representative, then I'll come to the Senate. Representative Comfort.
Thank you so much, Mr. Co-Chair. And I share your concern about vacancies and recruitment and retention. And just want to remind anybody listening, we're not just simply talking about people whose job it is to squeeze more money out of the folks that owe it to the state of Oregon, although you know I have strong feelings about that occurring. But it's also people who are there to help Oregonians,
right,
whether it's answering tax questions or putting together a payment plan. So a lot of people needed. Ms. Ray, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question is, we talked very briefly about the interface with the Department of Justice, and yet we've got legislation that's moving forward under Senate Bill 89 that would bring to you the delinquent debt from 130 state agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard the governor speak to that in her press conference last week as well. GenTax and the resources that you've got, how are you going to be able to deal with that broader impact when all of those accounts, I think I've described it in this committee before, is landing on you with a thud?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we need more. Quite frankly, we need more resources. At last count, I believe in Patrick Heath, our LFO, I'm sorry. CFO, I'm sorry, wrong letter. Our CFO can speak to this a little more succinctly than I can, but I do believe that there were roughly 13 positions that need to be addressed, but we would need another 10 positions in addition to that 13. So we're looking at about 23 positions that we would need in order to satisfy what I believe the legislative intent of Senate Bill 89. We need more resources, and I'll take it one step further. You know, as more legislation is initiated and passed, as we see more attention paid to the department and our obligations, we will need more. I mean, we just will. And so in this particular instance, I'm able to directly respond to the question. But as these, you know, initiatives come flying fast and furiously, we are calculating on a daily basis what we need to meet all of these varying objectives.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Ray, I don't mean to seem argumentative about this, but in 2013, we approved another 30 positions in revenue that went unfilled. Now you're saying we need more positions to meet the increased demand. This committee is coming forward and saying, here's the money for those positions. What we're not talking about is creating another 23 vacancies. We need to find a way to create 23 positions that are filled and doing the job that the governor, that you and this committee wants to see accomplished. How do we... You're going to talk about this in more detail, I understand, but you say we need more resources. We say we're providing the resources, and they're turning into vacancies.
Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, members of the department, and I'm answering this question in a bit of a vacuum. I think there has to be a more comprehensive approach to how I'm answering these questions. We have been tasked with answering many levels of questions about our vacancies, about what's needed in very specific instances, and we're doing our best to address them in total, but very specifically. So to answer that specific question, that's where we are. But a lot of this is contingent upon what we are granted at the end of the day, where our budget ends, where our vacancy list ends. A lot of decisions have to be made before we can give the type of succinct answers I think that you want at this point.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, I know we're watching the clock, but am I correct, Director, that there's about 100 vacancies in the department right now?
Roughly, yes, you are correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I'm sorry that I came in just a wee bit late. I'm still struggling with the Child Support Division and you guys. And you were nice enough to respond in writing. And nowhere in there did I see the words, this problem has now been fixed, and a list of like 3,200 people who had their tax returns grabbed up by you. I don't know what the status of those, that they didn't know a child support obligation. I don't know what the status of clearing that backlog is. And when I see statements like this, we will continue to work with DCS to assure we can maintain accurate accounts. We've talked to them. We're working on it. I want to know where's the part that says it's fixed. And this list of 3,200 people who erroneously had their tax returns grabbed, and some of these folks really heavily relying on any refunds that might be coming, is it fixed?
Co-Chair Smith and Manning, members of the committee, we believe it is fixed. At last account, last inquiry, it has been fixed. Now, with respect to the 3,200, did you say, affected taxpayers, I'm making certain assumptions that the bulk of that was fixed as well. I have not had any subsequent interaction about this issue other than it has been resolved to DCBS's satisfaction. No, DCS's satisfaction. So I don't have much else to offer. I will commit, however, to going back to my staff to ensure that it is as complete as they've shared with me. And if there is anything outstanding, I will certainly let you know. But we came prepared to present to this committee with the assurances that it is no longer an issue.
Okay. All right. Then the next question I've got is... has your system given rise to much more complicated paperwork? And the reason that I asked this is I was speaking to a fairly sophisticated tax filer. By that, I mean somebody with a professional degree, who said, I used to be able to crank out my taxes in pretty short order. And now I need, like, a guide to help me spelunk through all this paperwork. Has your system added a dimension of additional paperwork?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I'm not aware of any additional paperwork that is a result of the implementation of this system.
Okay. Cool.
All right. One last question, and then we're going to proceed forward. Talk to us about your last bullet point, working with our partners at DCBS and OED to correct system issues. Can you elaborate on what those system issues are and how we're working with them?
Sure. Co-Chair, we have, like I mentioned earlier, we have over 500 interfaces. We're taking a modern technology stack and trying to talk to some 30-year-old systems in some cases. We're working with our partner agencies who are, in some cases, have differing priorities and or limited resources as well to do the work on their end. Some of that coordination takes a little bit of time and effort. And that's what we're partnering with them on.
Specifically, though, what are the issues?
So we have some file format issues that we're working through in terms of what those legacy systems can receive and adjusting those. And we have zero out files and a lot of complexity that would bore everyone here, I'm sure, except for perhaps Representative Nierman. But
all right. Perfect. All right. Madam Director, anything else?
Not for me, thank you.
Okay. How do we want to proceed here? Who do you want to bring up?
We'd like to bring up Joanne Martin and Derek Gasparini.
Perfect. Welcome. If you'll just introduce yourself for the record, we'll turn this show over to you.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith, Manning, and the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanne Martin, and I am the administrator of the Personal Income Tax Division.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee. My name is Derek Gasparini. I am the Interim Business Division Administrator for the department.
Technical difficulties here. One moment.
No problem.
All right. You can go ahead to my, I think it's my third slide.
To me every time I use PowerPoint. That's why I just don't.
While we're going ahead and taking care of that, I'll go ahead and try to get started and see if we can have the picture. I'll just let you know my first slide was just to give you sort of a layout of my division so we could orient around what my division is made up of and to get a little bit of background on that.
Are we good there?
Yes. Okay. As the slide is showing, the Personal Income Tax Division is made up of three sections. We have a program services section, we have a compliance section, which is our audit function, and then we have our collection section. As I reported to you when I was here before, we have about 422 employees that are part of the division. What I'm trying to depict here with this slide is just, again, to give you an orientation of what the division is about. One of the pieces that I wanted to talk about today was to give you a little bit more in depth about what happens in each of those sections. First, what I wanted to talk about is the program services section, to give you, again, an idea of what happens in that area, the kind of staff we have, and the kind of work that they do. The program services section provides a lot of the background support for the personal income tax program. That area is responsible for developing forms as needed. It helps to interpret any policies and rules that we may need in order to fulfill tax obligations for the public and help them to understand how to meet those obligations. They produce booklets and pamphlets and so on. They also work with clarifying, some of the legislative rules that are passed, where they may, again, develop rules that help to clarify what people need to do on those. Additionally, they also work with software vendors when it comes to how do we process returns. And I think, Senator Johnson, you asked a question about, is it more difficult to file? We constantly work with software vendors that do develop a lot of soft programs that people can electronically file with. So I wouldn't say that it's necessarily that we've made it harder to file. It's just, you know, tax law is complex. And I think as people use this various software, they all work a little bit different. And the software itself may actually make it challenging sometimes to get the returns filed.
Let's push pause really quick. I want to do a training 101 here. And I need to be the student here, and I hope others will gain from this. Can you just tell us, what's the difference between compliance and collections?
Sure. Co-Chair Smith, the difference between compliance and collection, compliance is primarily what we call our audit area. So we've always just referred to that as compliance. And I realize we probably all throw that term around and have a different meaning to it. But for us in the Department of Revenue and the Personal Income Tax Division, compliance equals auditing or filing enforcement pursuit. Collections is simply exactly what it says. It's the pursuit of debt that hasn't been paid.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Oops, I flipped my page. So getting back a little bit again, just to helping you to understand what all happens in the program services area. So part of their job is to work with vendors in order to get a system up so we can have people file tax returns electronically as well as if they still choose by paper. We also have that fraud area that works on fraud detection. So where we're trying to find people that are trying to dupe us into believing that they're a real person. But we're also working with people themselves who've had been the victims of identity theft. So that happens in that particular area as well. And I think it's tomorrow that you'll hear from one of my section managers a little bit more about the fraud area. Also in the program services area, we work on stopping returns where there's processing errors. So if we have edits, when we look for common errors that people may make when they're filing, and we review that in that particular area, as well as we have staff that look for refund reviews when we're required to do that, and they also process anytime somebody may request penalty waivers. Additionally, one of the key components that has a direct impact with taxpayers is this is the section that houses our tax payer services unit, which is our call center that is the main general call center for the agency. And this is the area, again, that has direct contact, helping people with providing information, how to resolve tax issues, or helping them to get connected with the right area of the agency that they may need to work with. This particular area does work with a lot of key partners. It could be the Board of Accountancy. We might be working with the Federal Tax Administrator, Association of Tax Administrators. We interface with the state bar when need be, when we need to clarify any work that impacts their area, or vice versa, if they're calling us for assistance as well. We have a breakdown of staff in that area that's anywhere from operational policy analysts. We have ones, twos, and threes, as well as we have some tax auditor ones and twos that work on specifics of the tax law. And then we also have support staff that do, again, this refund review or processing of work. One of the challenges that I wanted to just touch on that this particular area faces is one I've already mentioned, which is, you know, the challenge of detecting fraud. Again, you'll get a bit of a report tomorrow from my section manager about fraud, but that is just one of the challenges that we have to deal with. How do we find fraud? How do we point to, how do we detect it without sweeping in returns that we don't need to take a look at? One of the other areas that is a challenge for this is just simply getting all the returns processed timely so taxpayers can get their refunds or know that their returns are filed and taken care of for the year.
So let me ask you this question, and I apologize. You're going to get a lot of 101 questions. Okay, these are elementary to you, but we're trying to get our arms around this. On the policy and systems, with 8 vacant positions, with a staff of only 27, that seems, you know, 1 in 3.5 at a ratio of 1 to 3.5 are vacant. What burden is that putting on your staff members, and what's that doing to employee morale?
Co-Chair Smith, I'll see if I can clarify a little bit on that. We do have 8 vacancies. Part of the reason that we have vacancies is we are having some people do what we call work out of class positions. In the policy area, we've traditionally used tax auditor ones and twos to help with the policy side of work. But we have been experimenting this biennium with using operational policy analyst 2 positions. So we've actually had people working and not having actual vacancies sitting there. But that meant we pulled some folks from maybe another area in the agency. So it's not that there isn't some trickle-down vacancy. It's just not happening in that particular unit. So that unit is actually staffed fully. I believe they might have one actual true vacancy.
Is that based upon just where the workload is at the time because of the cyclical nature of your work? I mean,
as far as why we did the work out of class?
Well, because, again, you're going to have to be patient with us here.
Well, and I will try to explain. I'm not sure that I'm doing a really good job of explaining. The reason that we appear to have the vacancy in that unit is because we have we do have vacant positions, but what we're looking at is whether we want to repurpose those positions in the future to a different job classification is the easier way for me to have. I should have said that.
Okay.
We are looking at the operational analyst 2 position as being what we think is a better fit for the work that happens today in that particular unit rather than continually using tax auditor positions in that particular role. So that's why the positions appear to be vacant, but we actually have people that are in what we call temporary work assignments doing the work for that unit. If I had that many vacancies in my policy area, I can assure you I'd be in big trouble.
Okay.
Because I wouldn't have anybody actually paying attention to the policy work. So we couldn't have those actually be vacant.
That helps me tremendously.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. And as I was moving through the unit, I was talking about the taxpayer services center where we have most of our calls happening. That unit has about 20 individuals in that unit. This year, for the first time, because we wanted to address customer service, we actually did a seasonal hiring. We've never done that before. We're piloting a program this season. We hired 6 people, and what we were able to do is take telephone calls that we could take some easier phone calls, make a skill set for that particular group of people, and take people, in a sense, just hired off the street that's only worked for the department for a couple months and train them to be able to answer specific questions. I don't have the final results on that yet since we're just getting through the season, but from what the information I'm getting from the manager of the unit has been a very good success for us. Next year,
So let me ask you, so then getting through the tax season, mm-hmm. So has last year's tax season and 2015, have those tax seasons been completed?
Yes, I believe, I should say, I believe everything has been done. As far as I know, there's not stragglers. I can double check on that and ensure that we have. But we did have some work that was written objections from last season that I believe we finished up, unfortunately, in February of this year. But I believe the bulk of anything else that we've needed to do, any refunds, that kind of thing, has been processed.
That answers my question.
Okay.
Perfect.
And I have a little bit in my presentation later on that I can talk a little bit about last season and this season that I think will help answer some of those questions as well.
Okay, perfect.
Anyways, I was saying that one of the challenges that we've had is just having enough staffing in our call center during our heavy peak season, which is usually between late January and into the mid-April season when the filing deadline is due. So hopefully our pilot project will continue to be something we can use in the future in order to help have enough staff on hand to answer phone calls. Yeah, I'd like to move into the middle part of the slide that I have up there, which is the compliance section. And that is, as I said, is what we consider our audit area. The auditors in this particular section work on looking at simple issue audits as well as they look at auditing businesses. They also will follow up on any filing enforcement, generally for self-employed filing people that have not met their obligations to file. But in addition to looking at the individual tax return, they also look at domestic C corporations, which are corporations that operate generally within the borders of Oregon, and they look at other pass-through entity types such as partnership situations. Auditors in the section review the entire federal and Oregon return for correctness, and if they do see issues that are not being addressed correctly, then they will contact the taxpayer and work through an audit that could be a single issue up to and including looking at the full return and all the schedules that were filed with that. As I was mentioned when I was here last time, we have 5 field offices located throughout the state, and we have a field office that operates out of our main headquarters.
Are there any plans to close any of those?
No, we don't have any plans to close any of the field offices. One of the things that I do want to be careful about that when I say not to close, we did have a couple of satellite offices. We had one in Newport, we had one in Pendleton, and we have one in Coos Bay that were staffed by 2 individuals in each of those offices. We had some staff turnover, and we're not doing well at getting anybody else to come in and work in those particular offices. So we did a study, took a look at where we were at, and made a determination that the maybe 2-person offices were not in the best benefit for our operations. So we did make a plan to move away from the one or two type person offices. So our main field offices, which is in Medford, Eugene, Bend, Gresham, Portland, are full staffed with at least 15 plus employees or more. Portland has a double unit in it, so that's about 30 people or plus in that office. So our plan is to keep that going. We do feel there's a lot of benefit to being out in communities where we can interact closer, again, with people that are in some of the population centers throughout the state, such as Bend, Medford, et cetera.
So how do you anticipate personnel in Bend working with citizens in Joseph?
Right. That is one of the challenges that we do have, Co-Chair Smith, is, you know, covering the state, how do we best do that? One of the things that we've looked at in some of the strategies that we've deployed in the past is to look at the population and demographics of the state, and where, you know, people are residing. I hate to say it, somewhat the numbers speak, but partly the numbers of population somewhat help us to determine where to go. Bend has been certainly a growing area. We have increased the office size there, and if I had some additional staff, I'd probably grow that one a little bit more. To answer your question directly, as far as how do we reach out, some of the things that we have been doing is developing our online services so folks can get services without having to necessarily come and see us. We certainly have our call centers available in order to, again, answer questions for them. In our audit capacity, the Bend office is one of our few offices that actually travels. I think it's a week out of every couple months that they're on the road, and they will go out and meet with taxpayers more in their location at their businesses. And it could be in Joseph, or it could be any place in eastern and central Oregon areas, their territory.
Let me ask this real quick. On the 13 vacant positions, how long have those been vacant?
I am going to have to go
on average.
On average, I guess I want to say at least probably 6 to 8 months or plus on those. And I apologize, I'm going totally off the top of my head.
That's close enough.
We try to fill them as soon as we can. What we do with auditors and collectors is we try to gather about 10 positions to make a class. So it's worth our, you know, not, I shouldn't say worth. It's an economy for us to train 10 people at one time as opposed to one at a time, and do the heavy lifting of one person, then one person, then one person.
So does it drag out the process for a citizen if they receive a letter from the state of Oregon knowing that we don't have enough personnel in place there? How do you manage that?
Chair Smith, I appreciate that question. I think it depends on the kind of letter and what they're getting the letter for. In our audit area, since auditors generate their cases based off of what they can produce, they should not have a lot of letters out there that somebody can't answer. It's kind of a one-to-one relationship with the taxpayer. Where we have bigger challenges would be in the collection area, or possibly when we generate letters through our return processing system. So something coming out of our suspended area, maybe fraud. That one, we have a lot of letters that go out, and that staff, if they're understaffed, then you can see a bigger impact there of the time to get answers back to folks.
Perfect. Thank you.
Let's see, I think I lost my place where I was at. I was mentioning about our field offices, and let's see. I think the next step that I wanted to go on, if we could just move to the next slide, I just wanted to give a little bit of an idea again on some of the strategy and some of the ways that we think about our audit process.
Let's go back to the previous slide.
Sure.
And colleagues, I apologize. We're going to be visiting for a couple of days here. On that call center, there's 17 vacant positions. And in the Revenue Committee, I introduced a bill that has since been sent down to Ways and Means and will be soon coming to our committee, in which we would create a direct line for CPAs to be able to call the Department of Revenue and be able to talk colleague to colleague.
Right.
And this came from the CPA Association, and part of the rationale for that was they thought many issues that currently are taking weeks or months could be resolved very quickly. And I was told in the Revenue Committee that we don't have the resources to do this. But I see 17 vacant positions. Right. Help me figure out why I was told that, but we have 17 positions.
Chair Smith, I will certainly do my best to try to do that. One thing I think I'd like to make sure I clarify, we on my chart up there, if you look on the left-hand lower column, there's one call center there, which is our general call center. And then the 17 vacant area is our collection call center area. That's where our revenue agent ones reside. I think I'm going to kind of break your question down into kind of two different aspects. So if I miss a piece of it, please bring me back on track with it. So in the collection call center where we have 17 vacancies, those are our RA1s who are working on collecting past due debt. It is a burden for us to have 17 positions vacant. It does place more calls on the people that are left to, again, get to taxpayers who are either calling us to resolve debt or ones that we're, you know, initiating calls with and they're returning calls back to us. So it does put more burden on the staff to, you know, answer more calls with less people. And so that is one of the challenges that we are facing right now in having those positions vacant. So that I kind of want to separate that call from the other call center. I think what happens with the CPAs and folks getting frustrated is when we do adjustments through the return processing system, so when something suspends or through fraud, that particular area actually does not have, that's my one area in my operations that doesn't have direct contact with taxpayers. They're kind of a production unit. We try to keep them focused on processing. And so they'll send out a letter, they'll ask for information. The taxpayer has to either write back in or they can now get on Revenue Online and submit information. And we're just now getting people, I think, used to thinking about going to Revenue Online to do something more electronic to transfer information back and forth. That is one of the areas that I do believe that we do need to look for how we can improve that process of getting more timely responses. It kind of comes as a first in, first out process. So if I wrote to you, let's say April 25th, and you responded right away, my workload may be actually having me back on April 10th. And so it might be 10 or 15 more days before I get to your information you sent to me. Or if the CPA wants to call in and try to resolve the situation, we don't have a good process for them to get directly to an employee. So I think I have to separate the return processing side of things between that and when we have somebody who's either under audit or under collections, where they do have an opportunity to have more of a one-on-one relationship with that auditor collector, whether it's the taxpayer themselves or their representative that may be contacting us.
So I'd appreciate just in the next couple of weeks if you could work with John and our committee to help us flush through that issue further.
I appreciate that opportunity.
Because you may have a better way to handle this than is being proposed. It's just, I know it's an issue that's been flagged in the public.
Right. And I, Co-Chair, I'd also, if I could just finish this one quick statement. I know that we did resurrect our tax practitioner message line, and I know that's not 100% the greatest way in order to interact. We do try to do a 24-hour turnaround when somebody does leave us a message, and or possibly even shorter time frame when we can do that. And I know there's some ways that we can improve on that as we've moved into our new system and as we're trying to get all these things settled in. I do strongly feel that there's a lot of areas around how we can interact with customers that we can take a look at. What can we do to improve and take those steps toward that? So I appreciate your concern, and certainly we want to get information timely to both taxpayers and practitioners whenever we can.
Wonderful. Senator, do you have a question?
I'll vote for your bill twice. I'm just now reading an email working on a constituent issue, and it says, I tried to call blank, and as is very common when calling, I got a voicemail. And I just think that for practitioners to be able to call in rather than all these letters back and forth, that would be a wonderful thing to have happen. Especially, I mean, you could staff it up during tax season and staff it back down on the off season.
Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, I do appreciate that comment. I would really look forward to some conversation about how we can handle getting better information, getting more timely information with practitioners. Again, like I said, I believe in our audit and our collection areas, we do a pretty good job. We just struggle, I think, in this other side of things. And it is very difficult to figure out what's the best way to get or to be able to have a venue for folks to call in. Sometimes it takes very specialized training for people when they are working with the practitioners. So to beef up my basic call center and add a bunch of folks, they still may not have enough knowledge or the skill set to be able to resolve the issue with if a tax practitioner is calling about how to interpret a law, something on that order. It may take an auditor, it may take one of our policy folks, and that's where we do have a slimmer set of staff in our policy area. So we do struggle to be able to man a live phone line. That is one of the challenges we have there. If I shifted some of my auditor staff, we could do that and help beef up and be ready to take calls from practitioners, but then I would be taking away from doing audits on returns that we need to look at that aren't correct and weren't filed.
Let's just visit this issue over the coming weeks, and we'll try to figure out a way to create a win-win for the department and for the public.
I appreciate that.
Representative Gumbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree. A win-win is certainly what we're looking at. And we're going to talk about the tax gap a little later today and in the coming days. But as long as I got Ms. Martin here, she's our field commander out in the field.
Uh-oh.
Here's my question. I'm looking up here at your organizational chart, and I'm seeing vacancies of between 10 and 20% in these various departments. And then I turn and I look at $600 million in delinquent debt only within the Department of Revenue, plus all this other stuff coming at you. But let's just talk about the $600 million that's owed to you right now. We talked about this before. We're talking about it louder now. When we come back in 2 years, what's going to be different?
Right. Chair Smith, Representative Gomberg, I hope when we come back that we'll be able to say we have fully staffed positions, that we have processes in place where we are, you know, on top of the debt. As we get better and better with working with our new system, I hope we find places that we can have efficiencies where it doesn't always take a person, maybe, and we can really have folks work on that particular area of debt collection. The one thing I would say about the vacancies, it would be not my goal to have the vacancies. As we've been looking at potential budget challenges coming down the road and where we may have to do reductions, et cetera, one of the discussions we've had at our leadership team is, do we fill positions and potentially have to reduce down the road, or do we hold some vacancy in order to get down the road and not have people say, why did you hire me, then turn around and let me go? I think that's one of the struggles that we're working with at this point in time. Generally speaking, as I started to say, with our audit area, just as we do with collections, we strive to collect around 10 positions, and then we hire a group of people, whether it's auditors or collectors or both. And then we accumulate vacancies for a little bit of time, and then we hire again. There's some economies for us to train a group of people rather than one-off, which takes a lot of energy and a lot of extra time to do that. And with some of the information that we had coming potentially down the road of where we might end up in our budget, we were, as a leadership team, made a decision that we would hold off and not fill the vacancies. What it's at the point in time was in December was when we were looking at filling positions and chose at that time not to go ahead and go down that road. But again, I think ideally we would have positions filled and people working in those to help us bring in that debt or help us identify where people should have paid more tax dollars.
Follow up?
No, not for now, thanks.
At a 101 level again.
Sure.
I think in the coming days, we're going to need to have a conversation about what assistance this committee can offer you folks as it relates to the governor's initiative and Rep. Gomberg's initiative. And I may even flip that and say Rep. Gomberg's initiative, that everyone's now jumping on the bandwagon of collections. Mm-hmm. What do we need to be doing to make sure you have the personnel, the resources you need to follow what the representative and Governor Brown are bringing forward for collections?
And I don't know if I should defer
and,
that
and
to
maybe,
my director.
and that's a question that why don't you think through it and be prepared in the coming days to address. But I really think that's on everyone's mind of how we're going to do that.
I certainly appreciate that. I have some awareness on some thoughts that we have had, but I would probably want to deflect to ask Director Ray to respond to you on that one. So I appreciate that.
Cool. And I apologize for interrupting you so much. I'll stay quiet for
a
while
now. No problem. And I want to be also watchful of time. Could I check in just in the sense of, are we?
You've got 40 minutes.
Okay. Because I think I probably should speed myself up in a way so I can get to my colleague next door. Derek, I could have you go forward again. Oh, you got the resource allocation plan up. I will briefly go over this, and I hope I don't cause more questions for you by doing that briefly. What I wanted to demonstrate here was just to let you know that in our audit area, we do deploy strategies, and what I'm trying to demonstrate with this is that each biennium, we develop what we call a resource allocation plan, the resource being our staffing. We take a look at the number of auditors we have. We also take into consideration information we have, such as one of my colleagues will be talking a little bit down the road here in the tax gap area, but we have reports from our research area that gives us information about where there is either non-filers or non-compliance. We take that into consideration, and as we develop a plan on the type of audits we're going to do, again, this is a very simple chart that tells you the types of areas that we audit in, but what I was trying to demonstrate is, again, that we do take it very serious. We try to find the right audits to get to. We utilize the system now to help us case select, and then we set out our audit plan. And again, this doesn't tell you particular industries or anything like that, but what we do focus our audits are simple issues where we can do just a correspondence, perhaps, exchange of information to clarify or find out if we have to bill. Complex issues might be that we have two or three issues that take a little bit more paperwork, a little bit more receipts in order to verify the activity that's happening. And then a business audit usually is more of a face-to-face audit. I shouldn't say usually, it most likely is, in order to understand somebody's business practices and happenings so we can, again, make sure that people are filing right. What this chart is showing you for the 2015-17 season, these are, again, just an idea of some of the audits that we completed. The two columns to the right-hand side that say low and high, that's just showing that our auditors do work in a range, and if, on the low end, if everybody just did the minimal work, then we would close the middle column of audits, and then our goal is hopefully to get closer to the higher end. I think one of you asked a question earlier about, you know, how much auditing that we do and how much effectiveness do we have. We currently audit about 1 point, or maybe about 1% of all the returns that are filed, which isn't a real high number of returns that we have the ability to look at. Business audits, pass-through entity audits, and complex audits take more time to work than the simple issue audits. So we're always trying to do a mixture and a balance of that. We're trying to spread ourselves across a number of different industries that are out there. It could be anything from, you know, people who have nail salons to people who have, you know, quick stop grocery stores to people who have, you know, whatever kind of business they may be in. So there's all kinds of areas that we know that there's noncompliance, and where we try to focus is areas where there's not third-party information to that we can verify easily, like a person who's a wage earner has a W-2 statement, or some people have 1099 information we can verify. So we're trying to focus our audits in areas where we don't have that kind of verification as we select audits.
Let me ask you this question real quick. Is it, in the past, I've asked this question. I know there's collaboration with the Internal Revenue Service. How do we go about utilizing the work they're doing in the field through their auditing work and making sure that we're utilizing their work? How do we do that?
Co-chair, one of the ways that we do that is when we understand areas that the IRS is auditing in, we may choose not to audit that particular area and go in a different direction, in part because once the IRS completes an audit, we get a copy of their audit report. We call it a revenue agent report. And once we get that file, if the taxpayer hasn't already amended and they're instructed to do so by the IRS, but if they haven't, when we get the information, we check on that. And if they have not amended for Oregon, then we have staff that will work and bill those billings. So that's one way that we try to leverage, not to do the same type of work they're doing, but to do something different. In reverse, we also, as we do our audits, we share those with the IRS as well. I think one of the challenges that we have been seeing over the last couple of years, and part of this depends on, again, what's happening on the federal level, is as their audit area shrinks or grows, that impacts us. So if they shrink in the number of agents and auditors they have out, chances are they're not going to do as much work, perhaps, on certain types of Oregon businesses that they may have done in the past. So we do see some shrinking and expanding depending on what happens on the IRS level. The impact to us is if they are doing less audits, then we're getting less reports that we can kind of leverage for a quicker audit. We don't have to really go in and do the audit. We just have to make the correction for the Oregon changes. So that is a detriment to us if the IRS doesn't do as much work in Oregon. And that puts the burden on us to have to expand bigger to cover more territory of types of audits that we may have to look at. I hope that answers what you were.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just curious. I wonder how many audits the IRS does in Oregon and how that compares with what you're doing. And I wonder, you know, are there dollars being left on the table that we could be collecting through stronger collaboration? But I think you're assuring us there is a strong collaboration.
Right. I would say that we definitely have good collaboration there. Like in all things, you could probably do more. I think sometimes we run into the challenge of they may have a focus in a way that isn't where we could go, or we don't have perhaps even the manpower to you know, hop on board with something. But generally, like I said, we try to leverage being in a different area than where they're auditing so we can have a little bit broader coverage.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
On that, yeah. If we could go to the next slide. Again, I wanted to demonstrate a little bit, again, where we use a metric. This is a specific one. It happens to be in the filing enforcement area. I'll try to kind of plow through this quickly so I can get to kind of some wrap-up area. What the top graph is showing you is prior to 2015, this was our filing enforcement. The blue bars are the cases that we were able to complete. The gold bar is what our goal was, and the gray bar was the previous biennium. And what I wanted to show you with this is, as we measured the work that we did, you can see that we had a pretty good gap of not being able to get to our goal area. In 2010, the Secretary of State did do a audit on us around our filing enforcement, and one of the recommendations they had and one of the pieces that they identified was perhaps we did not get to identifying as many leads as we could or processing those, and I think that this chart definitely clarifies that that was not necessarily a wrong conclusion. As a result of that audit, we took the information suggestions they had, and we did make some changes about our filing enforcement operations. One was trying to touch a wider swath of people. We maybe didn't go back as many years as we could audit, but we did try to improve the width of the number of people that we touched. As the bottom graph demonstrates, as we moved into the more recent biennium, as you can see, we were still somewhat struggling in the early part up through August or so of 2016 to get all of our leads done. One of the benefits we have had with moving into the GenTax system is, especially when it comes to wage earners or people who have income that is verified by a third party, like a 1099 is issued, we've been able to use data matching for that, and we can actually issue the notices now without people having to match data to do that. So the latter part of the bottom graph shows where we are now able to reach all the leads that we're getting in front
of
us.
Let me ask a question on this, and it's a 101 question. So as I look at the gold bar, I'm looking at the chart above. Mm-hmm. Filing enforcement means filing your tax return?
Right. It means you did not file, and you had a requirement to file, and you did not, and we notified you that you needed to file.
So during the time from, if I read your chart correctly, from December 13th mm-hmm. through June 15th, we were significantly under our goal
right.
of just getting Oregonians to file.
Right. And contact them to let them know that we needed them to file. We had identified them. We had 18 people that worked on that particular work, and they just could only process so much at a time.
I want to make sure I understand this. This is the people who needed to just simply get their tax return submitted.
Right. Correct, Chair Smith. Those are people we identified who had a filing requirement, and we knew that we needed to contact them because, again, in the end, it may be that they didn't.
Who are these Oregonians? Are these people who are, I want to be cautious in what I say, are these low-income Oregonians who feel as if they don't need to file but should? Or are these people who, for one reason or another, are deadbeats and don't want to file?
Chair Smith, I'm not sure that I can completely quantify that other than I can say it is probably across the board. We have people that are low-income. We do have people that are business people that should be filing. We have people that are wage earners that can make anywhere from probably, you know, a low income wage up to whomever, whatever, different kinds
If I read the chart correctly, that's thousands of Oregonians who should have been filing that never did.
Right. Correct.
That's a lot of money left on the table that could be going to a lot of valuable programs and services.
You're absolutely right, Chair Smith. There's also, I think John Hart, when he talks tax gap, will also give a little bit more context to non-filers and part of the gap there, because this does include people that haven't filed that had wages withheld from their pay. Mm-hmm. They may even be due a refund, but they just haven't filed a return.
Okay, so then the GenTax system is, if I go to the bottom chart and we start hitting around November 16th and we start seeing that we're not only meeting our goal, we're exceeding it.
Right.
It, correct. So we're back. Obviously, that's very, very right. positive.
And Chair Smith, right I do here. Appreciate my colleague stepping in. The one piece I did want to clarify, too, that we always have to keep in mind with filing enforcement is that is us estimating someone's return. We have some base information. I think I've shared this before, such as if you had not filed, I may not know whether you are or not married still, that you do or do not have the opportunity to claim children if you have children, that kind of thing. So when we do the filing enforcement notices, it is based on a very kind of conservative approach, single without children, that kind of thing, without any kind of itemized deduction. So the challenge with looking at the filing enforcement dollars is that they may not necessarily actually be owed. And as Derek said, some people do have withholdings that we actually already have on the books. And then as a person files their actual return, it may be that they owe more, they owe exactly what we said, they owe less, or they may actually qualify for a refund. So those are a little bit ambiguous dollars, I think, to just say, there's a lot of money left on the table, because it may not ultimately end up in that if they would file a true return.
Got it. Thank you. Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your point, I think Governor Brown spoke to this in part last week when she mentioned that there are many thousands of Oregonians who submit their federal tax returns but do not submit an Oregon tax return, which is a very telling story as well, and to whatever reasons they may choose not to respond here in Oregon, or whether they perceive that the consequences are different. My question, Ms. Martin, is this. I often talk about the delinquent accounts for the Department of Revenue being about $600 million. It would seem to me in order to have a delinquent account, you need to have an account. Right. And you're talking here about the 20% of the people that aren't even submitting returns. So am I correct in reading this that 20% of the people are not included in the $600 million that we list as delinquent?
Co-chairs and Representative Gumberg, no, that would not be correct. We do include that in the accounts receivable information. So their balance, so if I sent out a notice of failure to file, that would, and you hadn't paid it or you hadn't filed a return, once that becomes assessed and due or liquid and delinquent, then we would start collecting on that. So it becomes part of the AR. I hope I'm answering your question.
So just to clarify, if I'm understanding your question, Representative Gumberg, Chair Smith, Representative, that if the person has not filed a return, they're not a part of the AR or part of that $600 million. But if we have assessed them in the absence of them filing a return, and that is an estimated return that may not be true and may be inflated, that is part of the accounts receivable.
All right. Mr. Chair, I'm just going to repeat that back if I could. If we catch you and you owe us money, then you're part of the delinquent accounts. But if you're part of these people that haven't returned a tax return yet and we haven't followed up with you yet, then that's extra dollars that are going to pile on top of the $600 million that is currently delinquent.
Go ahead if you want.
I'm not quite sure exactly. I actually would want to defer to John Hart to talk about GAAP and the composition of that and what's included and what is not.
Happy to be patient. looks like staff might have a comment on that as well, Mr. Co-Chair.
I'd maybe just wait.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Before we move off this slide, and if I'm incorrect, I stand ready to be corrected. With the new system in place, does it make sense now for us to increase your goal? Will you think about that and we're going to make a note of that and we'll have a conversation.
I appreciate that. I am not always the best on those kind of on the spot questions. I certainly
want
to set goals that we can all achieve and work toward. So I'm sure there's some lifting of the goal that we can do, but I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it definitely looks like we're back on the right track.
Exactly.
And so let's think about what we need our goals to look like in the coming couple of years here.
I think I'm going to go ahead and just move this particular slide that I have. I just wanted to demonstrate. I wasn't planning on going through all of these different metrics. I just wanted you to have an awareness that we do have a variety of metrics in each of our program areas and sections within the division that we look at to help us drive our operations and to help us to look at the work that we're doing and are we meeting goals. So that is just a big laundry list of metrics, and I apologize. But I want to speed through and get to some of the other parts of my presentation. One of the pieces that I did, I want to be careful. I didn't want to gloss over the collection section. That was the last piece on my org chart. The only reason I'm somewhat doing that is I do know that you have a presentation coming up on Wednesday, and I think for part of Thursday that will go into a lot of depth on collections. So I think it's better if I could reserve that for that. But I did not want to ignore that we had that section or that the debt that we have out there isn't serious and something that we should be paying attention to. But it will get its due when they have that separate meeting. See, one of the pieces that I put up about challenging issues, again, and I won't dwell too long on this because we've talked about some of the things that are interwoven in the conversation so far. But one of the things that is a challenge for us across the board, I think across the agency, and Director Ray referred to this when she was talking a bit ago, is, you know, gaining proficiency in our new system is a challenge. There's a lot of places that we're doing well in, but there's also a lot of things for us to learn and for our staff to understand fully how to just utilize this full system. And that's something that we're getting better at all the time. Last season was the first season that my program was in the Gentax system, and this is our second season in it, and we are certainly doing better in a lot of areas, but it is a big system and there's a lot to learn.
Do you feel like we threw too much at you? Not you directly, but you know, at your collectively at the department threw too much at you with too high of an expectation, and then losing a director. Has that created issues?
Chair Smith, I appreciate the direction that you're going with that. I think that we all had maybe a little bit of a naive thought that this was going to be great. Well, you know, we've got this off-the-shelf system. We put it in and off we go. And hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn for my colleagues. But I think even myself had a little bit of maybe disillusionment, maybe Director Ray's chart that she shared at the beginning. Everyone's really excited. And, you know, a lot of things sounded very simple to get in place. And I think one of the things that we have discovered is while things are working, and they are, we are also realizing that you put something into play, not everything plays out like you think you programmed it to play out. I'll use an example of some of our output. One of the things I recently was asking one of my staff members is, what can we do to do how can we get our arms around a kind of a comprehensive review of our output? I think some of our output needs to be updated and to be made more clear. Some of the challenges I think we have is that this way that the output comes out to taxpayers, I'm going to call that sequencing, may not be in the right order. So they get a note and then they get another note, and they're not kind of coming out in a way that makes sense. And so the taxpayer's trying to figure out, what did they just send me? And it's not that we necessarily are trying to have bad output. I think what we didn't recognize is sometimes how the different steps come together and then what it produces through the system. So as we're learning those and those come to light, we obviously need to address them. It sounds easier than it is to just say, oh, we'll just go flip the switch, or we'll just go change this rule in order to address that. So I think that's one of the big challenges that we have is just, you know, what is all happening within this system, and how do we understand how it's impacting the folks that we're sending notices to. So that's one of the pieces that I do hope that we'll be able to accomplish, is just getting back and taking a look at what happens when we hit, you know, this button to do this action. What is the output from that, and then what does that do for the taxpayer or not? But that's a big task on top of, you know, just getting the system up and running and making sure the basic bells and whistles there are going. Our programming team and our team that prepped did an excellent job. Our users are working very hard to learn it, but it is a lot. It's a big lift to move all of our big programs into the system, and that may be a piece that we all didn't completely realize how much that was going to take for us to get there. And now it's kind of patience and time, and us working as hard as we can to smooth out those bumps and to get again just get more proficient with the system.
Cool. Thank you.
So that kind of went a little bit more in depth there on the gaining proficiency. One of the other things that I wanted to talk about, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of skipping a few of my bullet points, but I want to move on. But I want to make sure that I don't miss. I'm just kind of highlighting again, if you could move forward a slide, Derek. Our 2000, I call it 16 season. I was just going by tax years last year when we had our filing season challenges, and then this year. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of an idea. Again, as my slide up here shows, last year around this time, we were taking at least 22 days to process a return that was smooth. Nothing happened. It didn't, you know, stop for fraud or anything like that. Just everything went right with the return. It took about 22 days. This year, we're able to reduce that to 14 days. So we're a little bit back on track with a little bit more timely processing. In the manual review area last year during season, it took about 59 days to get something processed if there was a problem with it. It could have been fraud, it could have been a suspended action, something like that. So far to date, through April 25th of last week, we were processing about 29 days. Now, that number may slip a little bit because between April 1st and 15, we get about half of the 2 million returns that come in, so we will have a peak right now of things that we will be looking at, so we could elongate by the time we get through our processing season. One of the things that we did do last year, and I want to talk a little bit about some events and actions that happened. Last year, we were putting in some processing equipment in our processing center. And this was what we called our life cycle replacement. One of the challenges that we had was whether to bring up old systems and have kind of a backup system or not, or rely on our new systems coming in. We did have some challenges getting our new systems up, and unfortunately we had a decision that was made not to prepare the contingencies of having the old systems as a backup. It was in April of last year when we discovered that we were having a big backup with processing some of our paper returns. That would be paper filers, or people who file a return that has the scanning box, we call a 2D, that can help. We can scan it and process it a little bit faster. Once we discovered that we did have the problem that was happening, that definitely was impacting time frames for people to get their information into the system, we realized that as we were setting up and trying to key information in, we were making errors. We didn't have necessarily good data going in. Taxpayers were contacting us saying, this is not the outcome I should have had. So we put together a team that was able to kind of analyze what was going on and then start a mitigation plan. As you all know, and I think you all heard from a lot of taxpayers and constituents last year, a lot of frustration processing tax returns and getting refunds out. And I will definitely freely admit we definitely had a challenge last year. On top of trying to learn a new system and get that in place, we also had some of the challenges that happened in the front end of our system, which is getting information into our the paper returns into our system so we can, again, start looking for fraud and for other kinds of issues that may happen. The team that we ended up putting a team together, and we reshifted a lot of staff in the agency to focus on getting us through the processing season.
So really quick before we move on, to me, you can see the significant progress. To me, I mean, that's excellent. And in my view, refund processing time of 14 days seems very reasonable.
Right.
How does that compare nationally? Is that any idea?
Chair Smith, I haven't
unfair
seen the
question.
Number.
Unfair question.
No, it's actually a fair question. Sometimes I'm not the best at remembering certain numbers. I do know that we have some information that we look at other states. I can get that information if that's something that you would like. I would say we're relatively in there with other states, but I want to be careful that I'm not misleading on that. So I can definitely get some information on that for you if you'd like.
And on the manual review as well. Again, to me, that seems kind of reasonable, but I don't know how that compares to other states.
Chair Smith, I would say, given my experience over the years that being at the department, and I've been through a couple of rough seasons in the past, and as I've told my colleagues last year, yeah, when things go awry, it's not very fun for any of us, and it's very hard to get it back on track if something derails during processing season. So definitely this year is way smoother in many, many ways. It's not to say that we still don't have some challenges, that we still can't have improvements, responses back to taxpayers, practitioners, et cetera, but definitely it's night and day from last year to this season to this year as well.
Representative Newman, did you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay.
And one of the other things I just wanted to make sure that you all are aware, and I think that impacted why we were doing better this season, is we did seriously take a look at what all went wrong last year. We planned, we had mitigation plans in case we had any equipment failures, anything like that happening as we went into this processing season. In my particular area, once returns get into my staff's hands, we've also came up with a mitigation plan on how we can, again, shift some staff that are reassigned to working in our fraud and our suspense return area. One of the other challenges that we have, let's see, I just lost my place, or one of the other pieces of information that I wanted to share is, you know, there were impacts to my program last year as a result of having to shift staff. We did have to reassign some collectors last year to help do some keying or help process returns. Also, I had to reassign auditors, and as I told you, the auditors that were reassigned worked until I think it was February of this year to get written objections done. And that was at the cost of us not getting audits processed. So there was some impact to my programs. I believe we felt that we had approximately about $1.6 million in billings that we did not get to make because we were working on cleaning up some of the challenges from last year. And that's, again, just a kind of an approximate number that we put together if we had that staff doing other work during those months that they were helping us address some of the processing issues. And the last and final thing that I wanted to cover, and I apologize, I'm kind of hopping along here. I'm trying to pare things down here. So I wanted to address the POP 813 that we received last year, and I think we had a couple questions already about that POP. And I just put up here just for summary's sake, it had two components to it. One was an enforcement component, one was a collection component. We did meet the goal that we did have set out in that policy option package. And the piece that I wanted to address is what are we doing with the positions that we received? And I think Representative Gomberg, you had a question earlier around that. Basically, at least my experience at the department has been once we have a policy option package, we move into the subsequent bienniums, those positions become part of our current service level. In some cases, the positions may continue to do the work that was focused for that POP. Sometimes we also change the focus. For myself and my opinion, I believe that in the case of POP 813, many of the people that were hired to do those jobs, where we do have people still working in those jobs and not a vacancy, they're continuing to do the same kind of work. So in other words, the people that were hired to help us with collections are still collecting and focused on collections. A couple of exceptions were, as we were going through our CSR project, we had a couple of collection staff that were assigned to learn that new system to help train people and were a part of that active project. In the audit area, our positions are filled. We have one vacancy. People continue to do pass-through entity audits, business audits, et cetera. So we do continue to utilize the staff in that manner. So I hope I'm not being too brief on that, but I did want to address that we are continuing to use the staff.
So let me ask you this. With your policy option package goal and knowing that we have a, gosh, almost 20% vacancy.
Right.
What do you think, if we got those 17 positions in the field collection, those five in the field and some of those others filled, what do you think the result would be? What do you think we could get to? Could we get to $50 million?
Chair Smith, I would appreciate being able to go back and work with my collection manager to give you a number on that. I do think obviously if we had those positions filled, we would be bringing in some dollars.
Can you help me? I have a one-on-one question mm-hmm. here. When I'm thinking of collections, I think of kind of accounts receivable, mm-hmm. and you go back to the MBA days, and there's an aging of a collectibles.
Right.
And those that are less than 30 days are the ones that are easiest to collect. And
right.
then 60, you know where I'm going with this.
Right.
Have we collected all the easy ones already? Or is it like any business where you're always going to have collectibles at different stages?
Chair Smith, I would say the latter part that you just said, we're always going to have things at various different levels. It probably depends on what you define as easy. We have, some cases that as soon as they present a collection, a notice goes out, a person is calling us to get a payment plan going, or they're calling us even before the notice gets to them saying, how can I resolve this? So definitely we're always on top of those. The challenge is certainly as you get older and older on the debt, why people aren't calling us or why they're ignoring our notices gets to be a challenge. In my experience, and again, when we have our collection, when I have my collection section manager in here to talk to you on Wednesday and Thursday, I think he'll give you a lot of that background and information that you're looking for.
So where I'm going with this is if I hear you loud and clear, and I'm not meaning to cut you off.
No, that's right.
If we were to fill these vacant positions, what should be our new goal?
And again, Chair, I'm not trying to not answer your question. I think where I'm hesitating is we have a pretty lofty goal for this biennium. We're on track to meet that goal with our vacancies in place. So I feel like to answer your question, I'd like to step back with my section manager and ask him to rethink, and perhaps when he comes in on Wednesday, I can have him address that with you. And hopefully I'm not putting him on the spot. But he had a goal of, I think it was around $355 million to collect this biennium. He feels he's on track to do that. I think we feel we could do something additional if we had people working those extra accounts and helping us with that. And we set ourselves, I think it was for the biennium, about a 9% increase over the prior biennium. Part of that, I think Gentax is helping it. Part of it is getting people really focused on collections. So I would like to defer, if I could, to him, and then we'll see if he can answer some of that.
Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I think the one thing that's particularly interesting about this POP is not only that they exceeded the goals, but also that we spent about $3 million to do that,
mm-hmm.
Which in my MBA classes suggested a pretty good rate of return on the investment of staffing. To your question about the aging of debt, I think that becomes more complicated as you look at the fact that the longer we hold the debt, the more likely we are to farm it out to private collection agencies. The department actually generally tends to keep the shorter debt in-house, and the studies are showing, if I'm not mistaken, that department employees are doing a better rate of collecting, whether it's new debt or age debt. An interesting mix, which factors into this conversation about the vacancies and the number of people that we have in-house to do this work. The fewer people we have in-house or the more vacancies we have, the more debt we farm out to less efficient collectors.
Excellent point. John.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, a critical point here is to maybe have the department discuss how those results are determined, because it's not as easy as it sounds. It's not their ability to actually track those dollars coming in. They have to use an estimating methodology, and that's critical for the committee to understand, especially given the tenor of the discussion and moving forward, talking about vacancies, because there's some major nuances to that discussion. So if I would suggest, Mr. Co-Chair.
So let's be prepared to address that here in the coming days. One other thought on this really quick, and when you're here, when you've been here 18 years, you see the flow back and forth. And right now, the legislature is just pounding on you folks to collect money. At the same time, these are Oregonians. And so on Wednesday or in the future, I'd like to know how we're also making sure that that we're being sensitive to the good, hardworking Oregonians who, for one reason or another, found themselves in the crosshairs of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Because as much as I hate to say it, no one wants to.
Right.
We want to come to your picnic party, but not get a letter. And so how do you, in the future, I'd like to know how we balance that.
Absolutely. I can ask my collection manager if he can talk a little bit about that, Chair Smith, when we get to that piece. And I definitely agree with what you're saying. It is very tough. We try to be understanding of people's situations and yet also make sure that we can get folks to understand that while they have chosen to have XYZ debt, this is also a debt that maybe they didn't choose, but because of how they oriented their taxes or whatever they owe. And so we try to work with people to get them to prioritize that just as important as any other debt that they have. And
I remember being here in 2003, and the Department of Revenue was getting beat up because of their collection procedures.
Right.
And the legislature was saying, you need to quit beating up on Oregonians. Right. And now we're in a position where we're saying you need to be tougher. So
yes,
the pendulum swings.
Definitely agree with you, Chair Smith. And that is, I think, one of the balances that we are constantly trying to figure out, especially with our new system. We can do a lot of automation of activities, but sometimes that doesn't take into account individual people or situations. And we don't want to lose that as well as we work through our collection challenges. That pretty much concludes the personal income tax information that I was wanting to share with you today.
So, Derek, we have 7 minutes.
Yes, I'm sorry.
How do you want to do this? Do you want to hold off and start tomorrow? Would that be best for you? Do you want to kickstart for a couple minutes? Whatever you want to do. Madam Director, do you want to conclude with anything? Help. It's your folks' show.
I am up for anything, to be quite honest. So if the director would like to make some closing statements for today, that'd be great. I'd be happy to be continued tomorrow.
Mr. Co-Chair, is that all right? Why don't we do that? Madam Director, come on up. Give us a few final thoughts, and then we'll wrap up for the day. And then just so we're all clear, though, Derek, we'll make sure you're all ready to go first thing in the tomorrow.
Okay. Co-chairs and members of the committee, first of all, thank you for allowing us to continue Derek's presentation tomorrow. He has worked diligently on his presentation, and I think he has quite a bit to offer and quite a bit that you will find useful as you make the decisions that you have been entrusted to make. Just a few final words about our relationship with you as the committee. We are here to help you. And we've had some very tough conversations about the expectations of the department, leadership roles, and even the perception of the department externally. At the end of the day, we are here to make it easier for you to make the decisions that you have to make, and to the degree that we can, to bolster that external perception through our customer service efforts, our employee engagement, and just being good stewards of public dollars. So I hope the remainder of our 2 weeks is met with that sentiment, and once again, we're here for you.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Madam Director. My fellow senators, we're going to have a little bit of a challenge tomorrow in that we have House floor from 2 to 4. And so Mr. Co-Chair, I will make sure that I am down here joining us for committee. Members,
I'll be here for a gavel whack, and then I'll be back to the floor.
If you can come
be
down,
here for a gavel whack.
Yeah, come down, get a quorum, and then those who can get excused and want to, great. Those who need to be on the floor, fully understand.
You can see the back of my head for committee meetings. So.
All righty. John, anything we need to think about as we wrap up? All right. Michael, we good?
Yes, sir.
All right. Colleagues, we're going to adjourn for the day. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am. All right. Colleagues, we're going to adjourn for the day.